Well, this morning we come to the end of 1 Samuel. Our passage this morning is the last book in, or the last chapter of 1 Samuel, chapter 31. We'll be reading the entire chapter. It's not too long, and it's also printed for you in your bulletins as well. So from 1 Samuel chapter 31, beginning in verse 1, this is the word of the Lord. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. And then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. And therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men on the same day together. And when the men of Israel, who were on the other side of the valley, and those beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shen. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth-shen, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. This has been the reading of God's word. Please be seated. What is it about human beings and our love of tragedies? Shakespeare has comedies, but if we're being totally honest, they're just okay. It's the tragedies. It's the tragedies that allows Shakespeare to transcend time and space and culture. It's the Romeo and Juliets and the Macbeths and the Hamlets that still speak to us. How many of our great stories, our great movies, they don't end with happily ever after, but they end with death and with sadness and with grief and with tragedy. Now you may be thinking, well, I don't like tragedies. That's not my cup of tea when it comes to art and pop culture and entertainment. But it's not just our choices of entertainment. Think about how you're driving on the freeway and traffic slows down because a crash has happened on the complete other side of the road that has nothing to do with your direction of travel. We all turn our heads and we all look at what's happened. I'm fascinated by local news, like the nightly news that's on local stations. I don't understand the local news. I grew up in a home that always had the local news on, and I just haven't got it as an adult. Because here's a sample I took just an afternoon last week. Let me give you this. So tonight at 10, here's what we're going to look at together. A jewelry store was robbed in Fountain Valley. A pedestrian was severely injured in a hit and run in East Hollywood. A Valley Village man was attacked by his neighbor's dog. A Ventura man pled guilty to the attempted murder of his ex-girlfriend. That's just a sample. And what I'm about to say, I mean with all due respect, especially to the families who were involved, because those are some incredible tragedies to those families. But with all due respect, my question is, who cares? What does that have to do with me and my life? I don't know any of these people. I will never get to know those people. I don't even live in proximity to those people to some extent. Why do we want this information? Well, there might be a scientific reason we want that information. You see, what happens is that we actually observe a bad thing happening, and this data enters our perceptual system and stimulates our amygdala in our brains. And that's the part of our brain responsible for emotions and survival tactics and memory. And then the amygdala, it sends signals to the front of our brain, the frontal cortex, and that's where we interpret the data. And that's where we evaluate, does this have anything to do with me and should I be concerned? It's flight or fight that kicks in at that point. A response is evoked. And what happens is that stimulated, whether we're watching Saving Private Ryan on TV or if we watch the evening news. But maybe there's something there. Maybe this is even a response we might get when we come to the Bible. Because the Bible is filled with tragedy, and so you start to think, if I'm interpreting this data in the Bible, maybe the response should be, what do I do with the data? Does it have anything to do with me? Why is this so tragic, and why do I need to hear this? When Saul and David are mirrors by which we can honestly analyze our own hearts, we start to analyze the data, and we start to explore why, what does this have to do with me? What response does it demand of me? The story of Saul is the most Shakespearean of tragedies in all of the Bible. Many of us are familiar with Handel's Messiah. That's the great work in the English language. It's performed each year around Christmas time. You have the Hallelujah chorus. And Handel also wrote music to an oratorio. It's like an opera that's just sung. It's not acted out. And the words came from Charles Jennens, who also wrote the words to Messiah. And the words of this was called Saul. And it was a story of Saul. It took place from David and Goliath all the way to Saul's death. And the most famous piece of music from that lesser-known work, which is fitting for today's sermon, was called the Death March. And the Death March was played at the funeral of George Washington. It was played accompanying the caravan of Abraham Lincoln's body back to Springfield where he was buried. It was played at Winston Churchill's funeral and so many other dignitaries of state. And this morning we're looking at that story of the Death March, aren't we? What do we do with this tragedy? What we just read together? There's no hope here. It's all sad. It's all grieving. Well, on the one hand, I want us to spend time looking at the tragic ending of Saul because he's dying in order to pave the way to David, who is now ready to ascend to the throne. But I want to keep a bigger picture in view. I want us to think about themes and emphases that we've looked at over the past 18 months off and on as we've spent time in 1 Samuel. See, all the way back when I first preached in 1 Samuel chapter 1, it was the beginning of August of 2018. And there was a prominent American preacher who argued at that time that we needed to unhitch our faith from the Old Testament. And if we're honest, if we want to give him the benefit of the doubt, there have been many times as we go through a book like Judges or 1 Samuel where it sounds like a good idea. Maybe we should unhitch our faith from the Old Testament. After all, aren't there more immediately helpful and relevant parts of the Bible to speak to us in our context here and now? But I argue then, and as we'll reflect on now, there are three prominent reasons that we want to stay hitched to a book like 1 Samuel, setting aside Jesus and the apostles also hitching their faith to the Old Testament. The three reasons I said back in August of 2018 that we're picking up now is that we learn an awful lot about the human heart. We learn about the character of God, the same God. And we learn about our desperate need for a king. The human heart, the character of God, and our need for a king. And then we're going to look at that with two main points this morning. We're going to look at the tragedy of Saul and then the gospel of Saul. The tragedy of Saul and the gospel of Saul. That we all know what is coming makes this reading no less hard to read. That we know that this is just the ending makes this no less tragic or hard to stomach. If you remember from past weeks, even though 1 and 2 Samuel are two distinct books in our Bibles, it actually was one book of Samuel that was split into two books for pragmatic reasons. What will fit on a single scroll? That being said, those who are making those editorial decisions weren't dumb. This is a pretty good place to put the intermission. So it kind of reminds me if you're watching like an older epic film, right, that almost runs 4 hours and needs the intermission, like Dr. Zhivago or Lawrence of Arabia or Gone with the Wind. And so the death of Saul isn't the end of the story. It's the end of the first act. This is intermission right here. Saul dies. Because the books of Samuel are about Israel's greatest king, David. He is the protagonist. So what have we seen in Act 1? Well, Israel has a desire for a king. We have Saul, who seemingly looks like the perfect king for Israel, but it's David. It's David who surpasses even what the people desire in having a king rule over them. So last week, if you weren't here, last week, real briefly, we looked at the story of David, who is acting every bit the anointed deliverer king that Israel needs. When David dies, the people long for a Messiah king like David. Why? What does that mean? Well, at least in part, go back and look at 1 Samuel 30. David and his men return home to find their things destroyed, their buildings burned, and their women and children kidnapped by the Amalekites. And the rest of the chapter is David pursuing the Amalekites in order to enact justice, in order to retrieve those family members who were taken. And I'm bringing this up because chronologically, this is important. While David is embodying this ideal warrior king pursuing the Amalekites, the Philistines are pursuing Saul in battle. This is the final judgment of Saul. This is the stamp, the final stamp on Saul's life that he has failed as king. It's the tragic ending that we all knew was coming. All the way back in 1 Samuel 9, the Lord tells Samuel the prophet, I'm going to send you this man from the land of Benjamin, that's Saul. And you're going to anoint him to be prince over my people. You know why you're going to anoint him? Because he shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have seen my people and their cry has come to me. What's the problem? Saul has not saved the people from the Philistines. Nothing has changed about the basic fact that the Philistines are still present and they're still dangerous. Saul hasn't changed anything about the Philistine threat. For all intents and purposes, right, nothing has changed. Before Saul was anointed king, the Philistines had their feet on the necks of the Israelites. When Saul dies, the Philistines still have their feet on the necks of the Israelites. Nothing has changed. Where has Saul failed? Where has Saul failed? Why was this tragedy inevitable? Saul's kingship has been more defined by self-preservation and self-exaltation. What that means is that instead of protecting Israel from her enemies, he's been consumed with paranoid envy at anyone who threatens his power and who threatens his standing. And of course, that's basically all meant, this paranoid envy toward David. The tragedy of tragedies in the life of Saul is that he himself has been the greatest enemy to his throne. I mentioned that quote a couple weeks ago from the second or third century BC Jewish writer who said, he who sins against himself is his own worst enemy. The Amalekites were nothing to Saul. At the end of the day, the Philistines are no real enemy to Saul. The only enemy that Saul couldn't overcome was the enemy of himself. If faith is resting and receiving the promises of God, Saul shows us the tragedy of unbelief because he exemplifies a life of toiling in vain and rejecting the promises of God to him. So the question for us right now is, how do we relate to this tragedy of Saul? Let me offer you a couple of ways we relate to Saul's broken kingship. And none of this is too new. This is a little bit of a review. Saul lived by the opposite of faith. What do we say when that happens? That means he lived by sight. Well, what does it actually mean to live by sight? Well, Saul gives us really tangible examples of what it means to live by sight. For a king, this means when it's time to go to battle, and you can imagine battle's always going to bring out, where do you put your trust? What are you relying upon? As a king, when Saul went to battle, what does he do? I always phrase it this way. When Saul went to battle, he always counted. He always counted, right? He sees the enemy, and then immediately he goes and he takes inventory of his troops. When he sees the enemy, he takes an inventory of his weapons and his arsenal. He weighs his odds. How do we count? How do we count? Parents, when we think we can make all the right decisions to keep our kids on the straight and narrow, you know what we do? We count. If we think we can keep our children from pain and from hard circumstances and hard things, what do? We count. If you think that you can strategize and secure your future, I'm not talking about wise planning, you count. But I think most of us also know that there's a really fine line between securing our future and wise planning, isn't there? And we also know not only is that line thin, but we also know what it is to cross it. If we think that what we do today secures tomorrow, that is counting. Social media is the most obvious example of counting. Every like that I get is a surge that I am okay, because I'm accepted. And so we live by counting. To live by faith, on the other hand, is to experience the world as open to God. This happens primarily through a life of prayer. David kind of embodies this a lot when he inquires of the Lord. That's where he goes. You stay dependent upon God. It's when you look at your life and you don't know how it will turn out. You look at the mess that you're in and you don't know how God will redeem the situation. But you can say with Jonathan and with David, as we saw back in 1 Samuel 14, whether by many or by few, the Lord will deliver if he wants to. When you count, you live by insecurity. Remember the song that rang throughout Israel. This was the great folk song in Israel. Saul cut down 1,000. David cut down 10,000. And the song meant, check out Saul and David, the 1-2 Philistine whooping duo. But what did Saul hear when he heard that song? David is stealing my glory. David is getting all the likes. Saul will live by counting, but he will die by counting. Saul will live starving for glory. And the last thing he will ever say, as we'll see in just a second, will be about preserving his reputation before man. The tragedy of Saul is spiritual death, but his spiritual death plays out on the battlefield in a very real way. The last day of his life, the Israelites are forced to flee while the Philistines pursue them. And in the end, Saul and his sons lay dead. The Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. Before Saul dies, he has the tragic end of being a spectator to his failure before he experiences it. We've come to know Jonathan. It almost feels harsh, doesn't it, to just read in a passing sentence and Jonathan was killed. Because Jonathan was unlike his father. He attacked the Philistines in the strength of the Lord. Jonathan did not live by sight. He lived by faith. He interpreted the world through the lens of faith. And just like that, he struck down in battle. But this is Saul's tragedy. It's not Jonathan's tragedy. As Dale Ralph Davis puts it, Jonathan laid aside a kingdom he could not have to gain a kingdom he could not lose. Jonathan's death is mentioned in passing, but Jonathan will not be forgotten because God will not forget him. Jonathan dies in the Lord. Jonathan dies not in rejection. Jonathan dies in the acceptance of his God. Saul, on the other hand, tragically loses everything. There are two words repeated throughout this passage, which are really interesting in light of the book as a whole. We don't want to miss these. The repeated words are falling and fleeing. At the beginning of the book, the Israelites are always fleeing the Philistines. I know it was a long time ago, and maybe many of you weren't even here, but remember the first priest we read about in the book of Samuel. It was the high priest Eli. That's who Samuel would be an apprentice to when he was just a boy. And Eli has two wicked sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and eventually they go to battle against the Philistines, and the Ark of the Covenant is taken into battle as a kind of good luck charm, as a kind of emblem that the Lord is present. But the Ark is captured and taken back to Philistine land, and Hophni and Phinehas fall in battle. Eli's an old man, so he doesn't go to battle. He's back home, and he's reclining on a chair, and he's told, Eli, your sons have fallen in battle, and the ark has been captured by the Philistines, and Eli tips his chair back and breaks his neck and dies. He too falls. And the glory, we're told, has departed from Israel. See, it's that kind of crisis that leads Israel to desire a king like the nations. And they gravitate towards Saul because he is a Hollywood leading man looking guy, a perfect choice for a king. And yet the more things change, the more they stay the same. While the Philistines were the ones we're told who fled when David was commanding Saul's army, now it's the Israelites who are once again fleeing. It's the leaders of Israel who are once again falling. And Saul is just another failed leader like Eli, who falls to his death. And once again, the glory has departed from Israel. Saul is wounded by the arrows of Philistine archers, and he knows that he will die. He turns to his armor bearer. Remember who used to be his armor bearer? It was David. And he pleads with his unnamed armor bearer to strike him down. I'd rather die at your hands, Saul says, than be at the mercy of the uncircumcised Philistines who might mistreat me. What does the king care about in his last breath? Himself. When Samuel announces to Saul, the kingdom has been torn from your hands, Saul says, okay, but make sure that you save my face before the people. And the last thing Saul does when he dies is he says, make sure they don't do anything to my body. The armor bearer, struck with fear, refuses. And so Saul takes his own sword and he falls on it. The armor bearer freaks out. He sees that. He falls on his own sword and dies. And the conclusion in verse 6, which is to be read slowly, methodically, comprehensively, is that Saul died, his three sons died, his armor bearer and all his men on the same day together. Total annihilation, total defeat. Saul dies and the people no longer have a king to look to. Verse 7 indicates, this is what it meant for the king to die. You have no figurehead, right? There's a loss of identity. There's a loss of confidence. They run, they scatter. Their king has fallen. They have nowhere else to go. They are forced into exile as the Philistines enact total and complete victory. It's the tragedy of Saul. We all knew it was coming, right? Just about everything I said, if you've been with us, you knew this was all coming. You knew this tragedy was inevitable. It was unavoidable. This was the thorough, tragic ending of Saul. But Saul has fallen and a new king will rise, David. The tragedy of Saul is pretty clear, isn't it? And so our second point, which is maybe the more complicated question, if the tragedy of Saul is clear, then what's the gospel of Saul? Where is there good news in this passage that we have read? Well, I think there is good news because the story teaches us about the character of God, and it does anticipate, even in a strange way, a victory for an equally desperate people. Why do we stay hitched to the Old Testament? Even this kind of bizarre passage about a king who falls on his own sword, it's because it's the same God, it's the same human heart, and it's the same need for a Savior that we have in Jesus. Even in this tragic and hard story about Saul's death, God's character is on display, and that's a good thing for us. Well, where is it on display? Where do we first see that? We see that God is a God of righteousness and justice. An interpretive key of the whole book of 1 Samuel, you go all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 2, and remember Hannah, the mother of Samuel. She's barren, and so she goes to the temple and she cries out to the Lord that she would conceive and that she would bear a son. And then she sings this song once she conceives Samuel. And what does the song consist of? One, that God is the God who hears her cries and sees her afflictions. That's a big theme. That's an important theme. Hannah, in her despair and despondency, prayed because she said, God, you are seeing all of this. Do something. And then she says, God is the God who raises the humble and he brings low the proud. By the way, Mary will pick that song up in the Gospel of Luke in the Magnificat. God is the God who raises the humble and brings down the proud. That's the interpretive key of this whole passage. Well, who's the proud in our passage? It's Saul, isn't it? Because the story only makes sense if Saul is actually a wicked king who rejects God and who hates God for who he is, and God will bring him to justice. David refused to lift his hand against God's anointed king. It wasn't because Saul didn't deserve it. He definitely deserved it. It was because he could trust that God was a God who saw Saul. And God was the God who would do something about it. And so, yes, Saul at times is morally ambiguous. He's always spiritually straightforward. But even the moral ambiguity is overstated, isn't it? This is the king who will murder all of the priests in Israel because he perceived they were kind to David. This is the king who puts himself first before his people, and God's kings don't do that. This is a king who abused his office, hell-bent, literally hell-bent, on murdering the most loyal subject in his kingdom because he's so consumed with envy and jealousy. And so the God who is sovereign over life and death sees this, and there will be an answer to that wickedness. And this is important because God allows us to keep our categories of wickedness and evil in this world, but he also gives us the language of hope that things will not always be this way. However, I'm not sure that's great news for you and I. It's good news in terms of God's character, that he is a God who is righteous and trustworthy and true, but I'm not sure if that's the best news for us because, of course, we're not just victims of sin, are we? We're also perpetrators. We use our swords to destroy, or our words to destroy, not our swords. We use our words to destroy. We love ourselves and we love our idols with heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? The issue is not God says, love me with all of your effort. And we say, no, we're not going to love anything with all of our effort. It's that we give our love to other things. We are contributors to the brokenness of this world. And so where is the good news for us? And you got to keep digging a little bit in 1 Samuel 31, but I think we find it. Take a look again at verses 8 through 13. All right, the next day, the Philistines came to strip the slain, and they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa, and they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. And they put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shan. But then you add these inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead who act courageously. And when they heard what the Philistines had done, all of the warriors, all of the valiant men arose and they went in the middle of the night and they took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons. They took them down off the wall and they buried the bones under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and they fasted for 7 days. How is this good news? Things just seem to be getting worse. The next day, the Philistines come to the blood-soaked battlefield to retrieve anything of value off the dead bodies. And all of a sudden, they realize that a Philistine good day just became a great day because there's the king of Israel and there's his royal household. There are his sons. And they cut off Saul's head. It's a tragic irony because remember, why is Saul so attractive? Because he's head and shoulders taller than anyone else. Now he's really going to be head and shoulders taller than everyone else. They're going to parade his decapitated head around Philistia. And they take his head and they take his armor. And check out the last line of verse 9. To carry the good news, literally to preach the gospel to the house of their idols and to the people. This is a religious celebration. The gods of the Philistines have won. This isn't just a strategic military victory. It's a theological victory. The gods of the Philistines have conquered Yahweh, the God of Israel. And they put the king's armor in the temple of their fertility goddess, Ashtaroth. And they hang the bodies of Saul and his sons as a spectacle. And they party all night long. And the only sign of at least compassion is when mighty men, warriors from Jabesh-Gilead, take down the bodies and bury them. That's fascinating because, you know, Saul acted the part of king once in his life. Just for a hot minute, Saul looked like a king. It was an episode where he delivered the people of Jabesh-Gilead from the Ammonites. And maybe you remember the story because he defeated a ruler named Nahash, which literally translates as serpent. And Nahash was wearing scales, chainmail, but it's literally translated as scales. And so David would prove himself as the faithful new Adam. But Saul, early in his reign, gave us a glimpse that maybe he is the new Adam. And the people of Jabesh-Gilead, unlike just about anybody else in Israel, remember a different Saul than anyone else. They remember a savior, a deliverer, a serpent crusher. And so they show courage and mercy to Saul's household, and they take down his body in order to give it a burial. So what do we do with this tragic part of the story of God's kingdom and God's king? We learn about the heart of God and the heart of the king we need and we have in Jesus. How do we do this? What do we possibly learn about the heart of God in this bizarre tragedy? Maybe some of you can see where I'm going. If not, it's that we have a God who is willing to be put to shame so that he might save his people. That is the truth of God that is revealed here in the death of Saul. We have a God who is willing to be put to shame in order to save his people. It was not Israel that was just defeated. It was not Saul who was just defeated. It was the reputation of God himself. And that tells us everything about the kind of God that we have. It tells us absolutely everything about the kind of salvation that we need. What kind of God suffers defeat and shame so that he might save the God of Israel? What kind of God suffers defeat and shame to save his rebellious people? The crucified God who is also our crucified King. Israel longed for a king to lead them from strength to strength and to finally defeat the enemies that surrounded them. The problem was that the strong they were looking to were actually weak in themselves. And ultimately, the problem wasn't the enemies that surrounded them. They were their own worst enemies. They had enemies of sin and death that needed to be conquered. We still get lured by worldly strength and wisdom and beauty and riches. It's why we confess with St. Paul that we long to know nothing but Christ and him crucified. And what's remarkable is to have a king who had suffered defeat. Because isn't Jesus a better Saul? Jesus, whose body would be hung in shame, a spectacle for all to see. I mean, this is crazy, right? The body would be taken down from its cursed tree. Saul had the loyal men of Jabesh Gilead. Jesus has Joseph of Arimathea. A loyal follower who carried the corpse of the so-called failure of a king, but he still knew him as his savior and as his deliverer. And though mighty to save and defeat his enemies, Jesus willingly exposed himself to his enemies, suffering defeat and shame, bearing our guilt so that we might have new life. What kind of God suffers defeat and shame? What kind of king lays down his life for his people? The God-man, King Jesus. What kind of God suffers defeat and shame to save rebellious people? The world doesn't know any kind of gods like that. The world knows plenty of gods that you can stuff in boxes and you can parade around for power. The world knows gods that demand and demand and demand and crush but do not satisfy. But here is something different, and here is something that changes everything. A God who pours himself out to save us from the wrath that we deserve. A God who gains his reputation over every false power in this world by defeating them in his death. Remember what 1 John 3 tells us. The Son of Man came to destroy the works of the devil. I don't know about you, but I want us to hitch to this story. Even though it's a little weird, it's a little dark. Because Jesus didn't come to a world that looked like a Sunday school flannograph. He didn't come to reinforce all the moral examples of the Bible. He came into this world of brokenness and sin and shame. He came into a world where we're still looking for kings in all the wrong places and still giving our hearts to idols that do not satisfy. And the good news is that he came as our conquering king. The good news, especially for you and I, is that the conquering king himself was conquered for our sin. But the good news is that he didn't stay dead. He didn't stay conquered, but rose in power and glory. Death could not hold him, and it cannot hold us. The way the book ends, of course, is silent and tragic. The men of Jabesh Gilead were told once they bury the bones, they fast for 7 days as they mourned their king. What happened on the 8th day after their fast? Well, we know what happened, don't we? At least presumably. They had to pull themselves up and go on. They had to look for a deliverer somewhere else. Jesus, on the other hand, is the one who interrupts the grief. And he interrupts the mourning, and he interrupts the fasting, and he interrupts the despair, because on the 3rd day, he came forth from the grave, the conquering one, holding in his hands the keys of death and hell. So why spend time hitched to Samuel? With all of our issues that haunt us and weigh us down, with all of the sins that plague our hearts, with all of the unbelief and doubts that creep in, with broken relationships that we have and broken hearts that we need mending, it's because we don't need coaching. We don't need more law giving. We need the gospel of the king who was conquered so that we might have life in him. At the end of the day, this is a story of the human heart that too easily is looking to the kings of the world in all the wrong places. It's seeking all of the idols that will let us down. It's a story, though, of the same God who suffers defeat and shame so that we might have a share in his glory. It's a story of a better king who rescued his bride, who defeated his enemies, and who raised us up so that we might reign with him. So even if we didn't know it, it's a story that we need, because this is the story that saves. Let us pray.